I'm Arun Vanagopal, in for Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Imagine being taken from the only family you've ever known. You're then placed with a family that knows nothing about you or your culture, and your birth family can do nothing about it. This is not the beginning of some awful movie, but the reality faced by countless Indigenous and Native families. According to the National Indian Child Welfare Association, up to 35% of Native children were removed from their families by state child welfare and private adoption agencies. That was until 1978, when the Indian Child Welfare Act was enacted and mandated federal requirements that protect the interests of the Native child, their family, and their tribe. The podcast This Land from Crooked Media focuses on a federal challenge to the law in their latest season.
Shockwaves are going through the Native American community. And that's after a federal judge calls landmark legislation involving Native American adoption illegal.
For the past 4 years, I've been following one case that's now sitting on the steps of the Supreme Court. How did this small step towards addressing generations of family separation become a target?
Melissa Harris-Perry recently spoke to Rebecca Nagel, journalist and host of This Land.
We are telling the story of one case. It's a federal lawsuit, and it started when a white couple living in the suburbs of Fort Worth wanted to adopt a Native American toddler, but that child's tribe, Navajo Nation, had identified a Navajo home, and a federal law called the Indian Child Welfare Act said that's where the child should go. And so the white couple sued, and they didn't only sue to get custody of the child, which they actually won and rather quickly, but they filed a federal lawsuit to try and strike ICWA down. We're still waiting to see if the Supreme Court will take that lawsuit. It's likely. And it's a lawsuit that threatens not only the future of this one law, but the legal structure defending tribes and the rights of tribal nations.
Let me take just one more beat on this particular story. So these potential adoptive parents actually were able to adopt the child. Why did they feel a desire and interest in addressing this particular policy, this law?
That's a really, really, really good question. The story that they tell publicly is that they filed the federal lawsuit at a time when it looked like they weren't going to win custody and the law was threatening to tear their family apart. But we were actually, in our reporting, able to piece together a timeline. And they actually filed the federal lawsuit the same week the child's tribes agreed to the adoption. And so they basically filed the lawsuit right before the path was cleared for them to adopt. And so it's a really good question. There's actually, the Brackeens are the namesake and the lead plaintiffs in the case, and there are actually three non-Native foster families who are part of the lawsuit. Two of those foster families successfully adopted the Native child in question. So why they pursued this lawsuit is a really good question.
All right, let's back up a little bit so that we can kind of move up to the moment of this case. Why was there even a need for the Indian Child Welfare Act? What's behind it?
So before ICWA passed, like you mentioned up top, an estimated 25 to 35% of Native kids had been removed from their tribes and from their families. And two things were going on. One, the Bureau of Indian Affairs was actually running a program called the Federal Indian Adoption Project to purposely take Native children away from their families and place them for adoption in white homes. And the second thing that was happening was racism in child welfare agencies that were looking at, you know, Native children being raised by a grandma and other things that are really common in Indigenous communities and saying that that was those parents or those families were unfit and taking the children. And so ICWA passed in 1978. And I think you can really think of it, too, as coming in a wave of civil rights legislations that we saw in the 60s and 70s that looked at racist and abusive practices that were happening in states. And Congress put measures in place to prevent that from happening. And ICWA was one of those measures to protect Native families and to prevent family separation in Native communities.
It's a stunning reminder that, you know, there was obviously a moral, emotional, political, ideological outcry in recent years when we've talked about family separation at the border relative to migrants coming in through the U.S. southern border. But it is a reminder that family separation was not a brand new policy at all in the U.S.
Absolutely. The United States government has been systematically separating Native children from their families for generations. And so in the late 1800s, the United States started rounding up Native children and forcing them to go to boarding schools, which were really assimilation camps. And the explicit goal of those schools was to separate Native children from their tribes and from their culture so that eventually there would no longer be Native people. The same goal was part of the Indian Adoption Project, the idea being just that Native children were simply better off in white homes. And I would argue that it's still happening today. You know, racial disparities for Native children and for Black children within foster care is shocking. We looked at one case that happened in Minneapolis. And in Minneapolis, Native kids are 35 times more likely to be removed from their families than white children. In the state of Minnesota, 1 in 3 Native kids before they turn 18 will enter foster care, and Native babies, 1 in 10 Native babies will enter foster care before their first birthday. For white babies that age, the rate is 1 in 100. And the majority of these kids are not being removed for allegations of abuse. The underlying things are neglect. And so this nebulous category of neglect is sweeping up disproportionate numbers of children who come from families that are poor and families of color.
Right. Neglect is often kind of a catch-all phrase for meaning poverty.
Exactly. And instead of, you know, and you can really see it in the stories that we tell this season, we go in depth in some of the stories that happened that precipitated this case. But like in one custody case, you know, a grandma had to fight the child welfare system for 3 years and then fight the white foster family that had her grandchild for about 1.5 years for another 3 years to finally be able to adopt her grandchild. And, you know, the circumstances that led to her grandchild going into foster care in the first place was just that the family became homeless. And, you know, you can look at their story and see if that had never happened, that child probably would not have spent all that time in the system.
But it does feel like, again, if we're talking about litigants who are able to successfully adopt in their individual case, that there still might be something going on here about presumptions of some kinds of families, maybe heterosexual, two-parent, married, you know, middle income or higher families as being inherently better for children. Do we actually know anything about what is inherently better for children relative to their life outcomes?
Yeah, so all the data shows that all children do better when they stay with family. And so children in foster care who are in what people call like a kinship placement are less likely actually to experience abuse and neglect while they're in the system. And even studies have traced them, like followed those children into adulthood, and those children have better outcomes. And so ICWA, which was passed in 1978, which is actually really ahead of its time because it prioritizes first placing children with family, then placing children with other tribal members, and then placing children in other Native homes. And child welfare policy across the board has really started to look more and more and more like ICWA. And I would say that there is a deep class bias, and you can find out, you know, I spent hours going through the transcripts of the actual underlying custody cases behind this federal lawsuit. And, you know, one of the foster fathers, you know, made an argument that he was a better home for a child because he had more bedrooms in his house. And he was worried that her aunt had too small of a house and she wouldn't have privacy. Another foster dad in one of these cases said that the grandmother shouldn't have custody because since the child had moved in with her grandmother, she looked heavier. And so he talked about the body size of a 7-year-old as a reason why he should have custody. And so all those messages around class are deeply embedded in these cases.
How is it that you found these stories in order to follow them? And I actually have an image of you in my head of sitting here reading, you know, kind of pouring through these cases and these arguments. But what was the initial spark? How'd you find them?
Well, so this case threatens the legal structure defending tribal sovereignty. And so in the lawsuit, they're not just arguing that the Indian Child Welfare Act, this, you know, piece of legislation that's really important for Native families, they're not just arguing that that should go away. It's this kind of tricky legal argument, but they're basically saying that ICWA is based on race and therefore it discriminates. You know, it's a disadvantage to these white foster parents. It's not fair to the native kid, and it should go away because it discriminates based on race. But there are a ton of laws, everything from healthcare to tribal self-governance to Indian gaming, where tribal nations, indigenous nations, and tribal citizens are treated differently, not based on race, but because of our unique political status and our treaty relationship with the United States government. And so the scary thing about this federal lawsuit is if ICWA is unconstitutional because it's based on race, well, what about the hospital where I'm going to go this afternoon for a doctor's appointment? Like, if you went to that hospital, if you're not enrolled in a few tribes that are here in northeastern Oklahoma, they would turn you away. So how is ICWA racial discrimination, but that hospital constitutional?
And you suspect, or the podcast suspects, that maybe that's sort of the ultimate goal here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we need to look at these cases like we would look at any other federal lawsuit. If there was a federal lawsuit threatening, say, reproductive rights and Roe v. Wade, we wouldn't pick apart the details of one abortion case. We would see it as a threat to Roe v. Wade. And what journalists and what the media, and I would say even sometimes the courts, have failed to do with these lawsuits is just look at the legal arguments that are being made and what are the implications of those legal arguments. And we can even look at the lawyers behind this case and see where else they've made it. They've made the same argument to try and stop tribal casinos from opening, the exact same argument. So without giving too much of what we get into in the season, further in the season, is that, you know, we found economic ties between the lawyers who are bringing these lawsuits. And we also, through FOIAs and actually through a hack that was very convenient for our journalism, a paper trail of people behind these cases talking about how they're for the benefit of states' rights and building conservative power.
But Rebecca, now I feel like we're about to go into this whole other land, which is, can the courts ever bring justice, right? Because the courts are always, right, it's that individual story. It's how do I rule in this case? It is sort of this micro focus when, of course, it is happening within this broader network. But that's almost like why we need legislation rather than courts making a decision like this. It makes me a bit nervous, just sort of knowing, again, the kind of fundamental narrow individual sort of way that courts typically tend to adjudicate cases.
I think this case and the story of this case and what we found in our investigation touches on these big questions about our democracy. In this case, the majority of U.S. states and the District of Columbia came out publicly supporting ICWA. The overwhelming majority of Native nations support this law. And there's basically a handful of adoption attorneys, corporate lawyers, and right-wing organizations and operatives, and six non-Native foster parents who've decided that it should go away. And if that argument was decided democratically, like, they wouldn't even get a vote. You know, they don't have the support and the base. But because they're using the federal court system, they're dangerously close to overturning a 40-year-old law. And I think we need to be talking about, as a society, is this really the role of the courts, or is it corrosive to our democracy?
And although it might seem almost obvious, I just want you to walk us through it for a moment. What difference does it make if tribal sovereignty is either lost or eroded?
Yeah, so there's a whole host of laws that treat people differently because they're citizens of a tribe, or treat tribal nations differently. And that goes all the way back to the beginning of the United States. And so tribes are sovereign nations. You know, we predate the United States. And so that sovereignty isn't something that the U.S. granted us. It's something that's actually inherent. And so our right to govern our citizens, our land, our languages, our culture, we need to be able to exercise that sovereignty if we're going to protect those things for future generations. And so that's kind of what's scary about this case, is that it could have a domino effect where, you know, this case is sort of the first thread that's pulled on a sweater that really undermines the legal structure defending tribes. And I think it's an easy thread for people to pull, because most people don't really know what a federally recognized tribe is, and they don't really understand the law behind treaties, and they don't know what ICWA is, or NAGPRA, or the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act. Like, all of these things are kind of new concepts for a lot of people. And so you can make a lot of radical arguments about tribes and tribal sovereignty, and people don't realize how radical they are.
Given the nature of the sovereignty, could tribal courts simply rule differently? I mean, is that basically a declaration of war? I mean, I'm not trying to be silly here. I'm trying to really think through the obvious challenges of sovereignty. And of course, because the title is this land, right? It is sovereignty, but also it is this adjacent and internal land space, which makes nationhood and state building quite difficult.
Yeah, so this is how I think of tribal sovereignty. Like I said, it's inherent, but of course it's been impacted by colonization. And it's something that generations of Native people, you know, we've had to advocate, negotiate, and carve out spaces for our tribes to still have rights and to still exist. You know, we're not supposed to be here. We're here because we pushed back. I think that's one of the other things that people who don't like the Indian Child Welfare Act don't like, because it gives tribes the right to intervene in child welfare cases. So just like, you know, I live here in Cherokee County in Oklahoma, and if I were a child, you know, the state of Oklahoma or my county could have a say in how a child welfare case goes. Well, tribes also have an invested interest in our children. And that's one thing that ICWA opponents really don't like, is that tribes can have a say in child welfare and adoption proceedings. There is this sort of, I think, fundamental lack of understanding of tribal sovereignty, and then also respect for tribal sovereignty, you know, and a recognition that tribes, you know, just like a state or just like a county, should be able to have a say in what's happening to their citizens.
I have so many more questions. We could be here all afternoon, but apparently I'm not allowed to do that. Rebecca Nagel, journalist and host of This Land, the award-winning documentary podcast. Rebecca is also a citizen of Cherokee Nation. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.